Good afternoon. On behalf of the AU Research Center, we want to thank you for attending today's presentation. This is the sixth in the series of Arts and Sciences Talks. This afternoon's presentation is entitled The Creative Writer and Political Engagement. We're very fortunate to have Dr. George Elliott Clark in attendance. Upcoming presentations. On April 7th, Sheila Greaves from the Center for Work and Community Studies is presenting Archaeology in the Rocky Mountains. On April 21st, Anne Nothoff, Center for Language and Literature, is presenting Teatro La Quintessina, Stuart Lemoyne's Commedia, at home and abroad. Our FOIP announcement. According to FOIP regulations, we must inform you that today's Arts and Sciences presentation is being recorded. The purpose of recording is to allow people who are unable to attend today's session to view the proceedings via Illuminate in the future. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Leslie Mayne Johnson, who will introduce today's speaker, Dr. George Elliott Clark. Thank you.
Okay, slight delays again here. Now I get to walk back over to my notes. I had to run over here to turn on the microphone. So, today we have the pleasure of planning a lot of technology and welcoming award-winning poet, playwright, and critic George Elliott Clark to our Arts and Science Research Talk Series. And as Shirley already mentioned, his general talk will be on the creative writer and political engagement. And we're going to hear a video recorded introduction remotely from Joe Pavato. So I think we'll move to the video now.
Hey, Joe. Somebody got that reference. 1960s. See, I don't know the song, I just know the title.
Everyone needs a degree in media technology. It's a sun.
Oh, yes. That's right. It's the Northern Lights. He's someplace in the South, isn't he? Okay. Is it on video? Okay. The problem is it's a Samsung, not a Sony.
Data.
Okay. See, I'm myself tutored by corporation advertisements. Before I get into a car, I gotta know. All right.
Thank you.
George Elliott Clark, and I'm a basketball person. George is an award-winning poet, playwright, author of the Redis, novelist, and scholar, who has been instrumental in the development of African-Canadian literary studies and post-colonial theory. Through my own work on ethnic minority writing, I have come to know and to admire George over many years, and count him among my friends. In 2002, he published his major book on the African diaspora called Odysseys Home, Mapping African-Canadian Literature. He is now E.J. Pratt Professor of Canadian Literature at the University of Toronto. George Elliott Clark was born in Windsor, Nova Scotia, a seventh-generation Canadian of African-American and Mi'kmaq heritage. He earned his B.A. honors in English from the University of Waterloo, an M.A. from the Dalhousie University, and a Ph.D. in English from Queen's University in 1993. After that, George taught at Duke University in the U.S. and has been visiting professor at many other institutions. A very articulate and engaging speaker, George is often invited to conferences and symposia around the world. Here's the cover of his book, Odysseys Home, which you can find in the Athabasca Library. As a writer, George Elliott Clark has published a variety of genres. There are collections of poetry such as Saltwater Spirituals and Deeper Blues, Lush Dreams, Blue Exile, Provençal Poems, Gold Indigos, and Blue. There is the verse novel, Layala Falls, which he published in 1990. That's the cover there. There is the verse play, Beatrice Chancy, in 1999. The verse play, Viola Falls, was staged in Venice, Italy in 2002, which is quite a coup for a Canadian writer. His opera, Beatrice Chancy, based on the play, with music by James Walton, had a production at the Citadel Theatre here in Edmonton in 2001. And was broadcast on CBC television. This powerful opera about slavery in Nova Scotia in the early 1800s won many rave reviews and enthusiastic audiences. His execution poems won the Governor General's Award for Poetry in 2001. And his last year, George released his novel, George and Rue. These books, as I say, are all available in the Athabasca Library and in local bookstores. Last June, George was in Edmonton to receive an honorary doctorate from the University of Alberta. For a list of his many awards and honors which George has received, I invite you to go to his website profile maintained at our Athabasca University site for Canadian writers. There you will also find his seminal essays, Must All Blackness Be American, and Treason of the Black Intellectuals. George, welcome back to Edmonton, and welcome to Athabasca University. I'm only sorry that Nathan and Emma and I are unable to greet you personally. Thank you.
Wow.
Course in comparative Canadian literature. Here is George's book, I Am the North Star, on African Canadian writers. The black covered book is Execution Poems with the Seal from the Governor General's Award. Blue. Les Bessites is a jazz libretto or a jazz opera. Beatrice Chancy kitchen roof, and Odyssey's home. Once again, George, welcome to Athabasca, and I'm sure you'll have some interesting things to say to my colleagues.
Wow. Video killed the radio star.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
I don't know where to begin. This is going to be really informal, and I hope that putting a mic like this will still be useful. Because you can see that it's registering over here, right?
Okay. It's all cartoons.
Anyway, I'm really, really thankful that we can be informal. And so I'm going to be informal. But first of all, let me begin by saying thank you all for being interested in hearing me talk. I also want to thank Dr. Jennifer Kelly, and a candid woman here, and for organizing my visit to Edmonton the last couple of days. And really, I can't say enough, as you already are all familiar, I'm sure, with Dr. Kelly. She's just been really amazing and enthusiastic in terms of putting together various programs in the last couple of days. So thanks very, very much again. And I think she's going to be leading a revolution here in very short order, beginning with the University of Alberta and moving over to Athabasca, I'm sure. In any event, again, it's really great to be here. And thanks for having the eats and the sweets, especially. Thank you. May we have enough sweets. Anyway, I'm a writer. I'm a poet. I'm also, a kind of intellectual. Scholar, as Joe Cavallo mentioned, and I should say thank you to him too, in case these remarks are being taped. You never know with all this technology around, you never know, you have to be careful. In fact, tonight on CNN, I noticed this morning that tonight, Paul is on, because I'll be talking about how school bus drivers in the U.S. are all being asked, all of them, millions of school bus drivers across the United States, are all being asked to keep a lookout for suspicious activity. Because nobody knows those neighborhoods that they drive to better than they do. And so Paul Azan's question is, are we being turned into a nation of spies? Yeah, it's probably true. I don't know if you like it, but my students come to class with those camera phones. And I wonder, oh my golly, all they got to do is like take a picture of me in one of my unfortunate moments. I'm saying, I'm misspeaking myself and saying a falsehood. And all of a sudden, I'll be all over the internet for millions of years, et cetera, et cetera. It's so terrible these days. We can all be so easily exposed and have our idiocies manifested even when we have repented and corrected ourselves. Nevertheless, we can't correct those mistakes. Anyway, I'm just getting started. I'm still being very, very informal. So I'm going to read some poetry. I'm so sorry about art and social change, right? Or art and education or
political engagement.
Oh, political engagement! See, this is all going over the internet now. Now, art and political change, is that? And political engagement, thank you. I remember he's talking quite what it used to be. But in any event, art and political engagement. Well, I guess I'll just start from the very beginning. I started to be a poet, a science-like poet when I was 15, which was back in 1975. The day I graduated from junior high school, the very same day I graduated from junior high school, grade 9 in Halifax, I went home with my diploma with a nice blue ribbon around it and sat down and started to write poetry. And the reason why, when I was 16, is that I couldn't be a musician. I couldn't be a rock star. I couldn't be a soul singer. I had to settle for second best, which was writing songs. So actually, and I say writing poetry, how I really began was to write songs. And I was very methodical about it. I wrote four songs every day. I called them songs. Sometimes I had a tune for them, sometimes I didn't. Sometimes they rhymed, and sometimes they didn't. But it was four songs every day, and I would generally try to write in a particular genre. So, okay, I'm going to write a country music song today. I'm going to write a soul song now. I'm going to write a disco song. I'm going to write a gospel song. And I would just go through these genres of different kinds of pop music. And so I was writing it. It was a very strange way to become a poet. But it's because I wasn't really thinking about becoming a poet. I just wanted to be a songwriter. But then I started reading all these books about how to be a better songwriter. And these books always mention people like Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell from the province next door, and a whole slew of other singer-songwriters, mainly American, a handful of Canadians. And these books all said the same thing. You can only be a good songwriter if you're a poet. If you want to be a decent songwriter, you've got to be a poet first. And of course, being impressionable, 15 and 16, I thought, gee whiz, these guys don't know what they're talking about. I better start studying poetry, then I'm going to write in decent songs. I don't want to end up like Bernie Taupin writing for Elton John or something like that. I gotta be more like Bob Dylan. I've got to have like a serious caliber in my songwriting. So anyway, I started reading all these books on poetry and how to write poetry. So within a year of getting started, I gravitated over towards writing poetry. 4 poems every day. And generally they did not rhyme. So I went from writing all these songs to writing what I now call poems, lyrics, and so on. And instead of writing about a genre, like country music or gospel, now I just wrote about whatever appealed to me. Now, of course, being a 16-year-old, what appealed to me were, and excuse the gender term, girls, cars, and being a rock star. And so my poems are all about these subjects and so on as a 16-year-old. I was also now in high school, and I gravitated towards English. My highest marks actually in high school were not in English. They were in social studies. So geography, history, and a little bit of civics, political science is where my greatest strengths were as a student in high school, not English. But nevertheless, I kept focusing on English because I wanted to be a better poet, so I could be a better songwriter. So by the time I finished high school, I had written thousands of really bad things. Really rotten pieces of work, a couple thousand, I remember four pieces every day, so 365 days. Yeah, I'm serious, it was 4 pieces every day. So over several years, I got over 1,000 at least, maybe a couple thousand by the time I finished high school, then it was time to go to university, and I decided I would go to the University of Waterloo from Halifax, which is a really strange place to go, I confess, but they had the co-op program, still have the co-op program, in English. And since I was coming from a working class background, my dad worked for the railway mainly for most of his life. My mother was a school teacher, and in fact started a kindergarten that employed Alexis McDonough, the former leader of the NDP, who was my kindergarten teacher, which is going to explain a lot already. She worked for my mom in Halifax. But nevertheless, my mother also was involved in the daycare movement, kindergarten movement for only part of her life, and then she moved on to salaried employment in other fields. But in any event, for the most part, my childhood was definitely working class childhood, although I had no sense of what that really meant. And the reason why I didn't have any sense of what that meant is because even though stats can, they have classed my family as working class, I felt growing up, I was very embarrassed growing up psychologically. I had all kinds of problems because I considered our family to be really rich. Really rich. And the reason why was not because of material things, it's because our household was full of music, art, and books. All 3, all the time. Not to mention CBC radio and news and discussions of the news and magazines and newspapers and all that sort. So even though on a material basis we would have been classed by Stats Canada as working class, etc., in terms of our cultural base of our household, it was very rich, immensely rich as anybody else's household in the real middle class and upper middle class communities. So I never had any kind of deficit in terms of an understanding of this culture growing up. Absolutely not. So I'm jumping around here in this little autobiographical discourse, but anyway, the time I finished high school, I'd written all these really dreadful poems. Bob was beginning to consider myself a poet, and so I'd go to Waterloo to get into the English program there. The reason why I talk about being working class and background is I was scared of having debt. I didn't want to have any debt. That idea just frightened the hell out of me. I didn't even like the idea of putting things away on layaway. Just scared me. I can't put it any better than that. I was just psychologically frightened of the idea of having debt. And so even though there were lots of people even then, back in the late 70s, saying, here, have some debt, I really was not interested in that. And so it was important for me to go to a university that was going to allow me to make my way through the educational process without acquiring a whole lot of debt. So by the time I finished, I went to a co-op, so they extended my credit when I was 19. So by the time I finished my schooling, I was 24, so it was an extra year of employment, paid employment. And during those years of paid employment, I actually worked for Queen's Park as a researcher in Toronto, the Ontario Legislature. I became a researcher for them because even though I was an English co-op student, I scored extremely high on the political science exam. Thanks to all those compositions at home and all those acclaimed magazines and newspapers coming into the house, well, I knew Canadian politics inside out. And so I ended up getting a job, political science job, even though I was an English student, and all the political science students hated me for that reason. I've been going on with all this background stuff, but this is all tied into political engagement, I guess, because I suppose the first thing about being politically engaged is being politically aware. And I started off being politically aware without even being aware that I was politically aware, because of the fact that I had parents who talked to me stuff like that. They never discussed anything in terms of their own political orientation, and I'm pretty sure that at different times in their lives they voted liberal, they voted conservative, voted NDP, at different times in their lives, absolutely. And so they never tried to say, you know, this is only one way to think about yourself ideologically and so on. And nevertheless, Alexa definitely pushed me toward the end. I'm just kidding. So nevertheless, we have all kinds of discussions about world issues, political issues, Watergate when that was happening in the U.S., the assassinations of King, Robert Kennedy, for that matter, John F. Kennedy, and so on. Trudeau, all these personages and policies and philosophies and problems all got discussed in our household. And so I ended up going to work for Queen's Park, partly as a result of, I think, all that childhood exposure to political contretemps and so on. But still thought myself as being a poet or trying to be a poet. And so I actually left my co-op job at Queen's Park to pursue my art as a poet by going up to Banff here and going to Banff School of Fine Arts for the first time and really, really honing my skills as a poet at that point. My first book had come out also that same year, 1983, when I was 23, called Saltwater Spirituals and Deeper Blues. But even though I had this book out, I still wasn't really clear about how I was going to be a poet or how that was going to connect to anything else politically. Although the poems in that first book talked a lot about Black history in Nova Scotia. One of the things that happened for me when I left Nova Scotia at the age of 19 and went down the road to Upper Canada, to Ontario, to Southern Ontario, rich, rich, rich Southern Ontario, where all the cars seemed much bigger than the ones I'd seen in Halifax, at least at that age. But when I got there, a funny thing happened. I became extremely homesick and nostalgic, and started writing all these poems about the Bay of Fundy, the Atlantic. I started writing about girls and cars and rock and roll and all this. The Atlantic, the Bay of Fundy, Black history in Nova Scotia and so on, and really I started reading a lot about it, because now that I was away from there, it all had a certain density and nostalgic romanticism for me that it had never had before. Before it was just a terribly oppressive, depressing place. But now, being away from it was a place of magic and beauty and music and history and romance and all the rest of it. And so the first book of poetry really, I think, comes out of that impulse of trying to deal with the nostalgia and the homesickness. And so I'm also trying to understand what it meant to come from this little Black community on the edge of nowhere, completely marginalized, cast off mainly from the United States and completely forgotten in African American for that. And also, for the most part, unknown in Canada. And so being in Southern Ontario, Waterloo, really got me thinking about those aspects of my identity that I never had to think about before. Because before it was totally natural, so now I had to react to that. I think again, that first book talked about these issues. Still at age 23, I go to Banff, and I get instruction how to be a real poet, for crying out loud. Not just somebody who's published a book, but somebody who knows what they're doing. Writing poetry, and it was really good. And of course, it was wonderful being in the Rockies with all those elk mating in the streets and so on, as they had a lot to do. And coming back to Halifax, I rode the bus 5 days from Banff to Halifax. I won't even mention to you what kind of problems that caused for my digestion and elimination systems. But nevertheless, it made me feel like a real artist now, having endured a 5-day bus trip. it was really great. I got to stop in all the major Western cities on the way back, too, which was good. But in any event, let me fast forward. So in writing that first book of poetry, I really did have some kind of political engagement because I was thinking about what it meant to be a Black Nova Scotian, our history, as a poem deal with the arrival of the Black Loyalists, the setting up of Black churches in Nova Scotia, and so on. And so, and as well as a kind of generalized socialist view of things was also there in that first book. And then got home to Nova Scotia. I almost forgot. I graduated in 84, but in the meantime, I also started working for the student newspaper at Waterloo called Imprint. And somehow I got elected editor by one vote. I managed to get elected editor of Imprint. And so that was my first post-graduation with my New England Honors BA in English, but without the co-op designation, so I quit the job at Queen's Park. So then I got my New England Honors BA, and I'm also running the newspaper, which at that time, 15,000 circulation, it was a weekly, and was the major newspaper for the students at the University of Waterloo. Anyway, and of course, fighting with the student government, talking about lots of campus issues. It was very exciting, and I learned a lot about journalism on the job. But finished up, I was only a year-long position, finished up in April 85. So now I'm 25 years old, and I head back to Nova Scotia with an honors BA in English and a year running a student newspaper, a weekly, one of the biggest in Canada, for crying out loud. No one's talking about journalism. And I'm looking for a job, and I got back home. Couldn't get a job. It was impossible. I couldn't get a job. And, I'm not going to say it was only because of racism. I'm also not going to leave that out either. I'm pretty sure that also played an impact on my economic opportunities at that age of my life back in Halifax. And I walked up and down those streets with my briefcase, with my little CV in it, and couldn't get anything. The closest I could get, the jobs I got were all laboring jobs, all of them. I had a job inside the Canadian Navy, painting the decks of Navy ships, which was interesting. And I was happy to have it because I had to pay my way and make my way in the world, and it was good to have that income. All I did think about trafficking and cocaine is selling it to the sailors and all that. But anyway, which would have been a good thing. But I thought it would have expected me to do that. I said, hey, buddy, you got any cocaine anyway. But I did that. Also, the closest job I could get to working in a newspaper was stuffing inserts in the paper, the major Halifax paper at Halifax Herald Limited, twice a week, Wednesday nights and Friday nights. Sorry, Tuesday nights and Friday nights, because Wednesday and Saturday would be the days with the big advertising flyer inserts, right? That was 8 hours from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. the next morning with a 15-minute break. Partway through. I got an honest BA. Now that's all right. But the other way, those are my two jobs. The weirdest thing is, I ended up finally getting a job offer to work for a newspaper, the Daily News in Halifax. And the guy who was then the editor became later on the editor of Frank Magazine, Lyndon Watkins. And so Lyndon Watkins, I walked in off the street and said, hey, I need a job. I can be a reporter. I worked on a paper. I can do all this type of stuff. And Lyndon Watkins, this guy from Britain, I got to give him his credit. He looked at me. I just walked in off the street, literally, because they had their offices on Brickwood Street in Halifax, right downtown. And he said, "Okay, how are you? But the deal is, you got to have a car in order to drive around, do your reporting job." And I said, "A car?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay." So how long do I have to get a car? He said, "1 week." I said, "All right." So I leave his office feeling good, I got a job, but I need to have a car. And then the same day, this is like wonderful, the world works in mysterious ways. The same day, I had an interview with another position for the Black United Front of Nova Scotia, which is a social services organization which no longer exists. Of course, it did at that point. They offered me a job as a social worker in black communities in Nova Scotia in the Indianapolis Valley. And they said, "You got to have a car." And I said, "Okay, how long, how much time, I don't have a car, how much time are they going to give me to get one?" And he said, "2 weeks." So I took that job. But there was another problem, though. That is, I didn't know how to drive. I didn't have a license, didn't know how to drive, didn't have a car. So having 2 weeks at a time was a good thing. So I went up to the country town, crossed there, and he taught me how to drive. And then he had a cousin who was unemployed, who was willing to ride around because under the Nova Scotia laws at that time, if you were just beginning to learn, you had to have a licensed driver drive with you all the time for 6 months before you could go to get your actual correct license, official license, and so on. And so he was happy to ride around with me for a cut of my meniscus salary, and of course lots of cigs and smokes and occasional beer and so on. So we made quite a team, popped up and down the Indianapolis Valley, in the summer or fall out of 85 into the spring of 86. But what was the greatest thing about that job is that it was a social service job. I was supposed to be helping people with the unemployment checks, welfare checks, interfacing with various social service agencies. But it was also, of course, very political. Extremely political because, of course, I was dealing with all these historical black communities in the Annapolis Valley going back 200 years. And the host of problems on every single front, including land claims, everything you can think of, was there. I'm going to say I did an extremely good job. I didn't. I don't think I did. I think I was merely managing problems as opposed to actually resolving any. I can't really say that I did. But what the really good thing about that job for me is it put me right back in the milieu of the people with whom I had grown up in the first place. And their language, their speech, their ways of life, their culture, our culture, which I had, in a sense, I won't say forgotten, but I had repressed through those years in university and so on, where I thought I had to be a certain way, we had to live up to a kind of ersatz British attitude of being and comportment and so on, and somehow forgot where I had come from, despite the fact that I was writing these poems about black Nova Scotian history and roots and all the rest of it. And so being in that role, being back in those communities, really plunged me back into the heart of blackness, or at least black Nova Scotianness. And as a result, my poetry completely transformed, utterly transformed. It went from being something that again, was this kind of ersatz modernism, strongly influenced by John Milton and P.S. Eliot, P.S. Eliot, as I like to say sometimes, and some of these others, into something that was more rootsy and grounded, just simply more grounded and more truthful and more honest, and so on, and ended up creating this book. I'm just talking too much. I know I should read, because I got to leave you time for questions. So I'm just going to read a few pieces now from this book called Wild Falls, which really, Wild Falls is a lot of things, but one of the things it is a book that came out of that year, especially in Annapolis Valley. Listening to people talk, writing down their stories, listening to the language and trying to capture that as much as possible in poetry and in the way I've learned to write poetry via Banff and via the University of Waterloo. This book is now 15 years old, still in print. In fact, it's my most popular title. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it's very down to earth in the way that it tries to communicate in poetry the experience of black Nova Scotian people, especially the rural communities. In fact, not one of these poems deals with Halifax, not one. My own treatment of Halifax comes much later in my career, even though I grew up there. But Halifax has been harder for me to come to terms with, and I'll talk about that later, because that was the site of class division and race division that really hit me as a teenager. And so for a long time, it was very hard for me to talk about it with any degree of self-knowledge, let alone understanding of the situation in which I found myself as a teenager. Anyway, enough of all that. I'm going to start with this poem, which is titled Look Homeward Exile, which was actually written in Amsterdam in a laundromat, washed the clothes spin, which got me thinking about my mother's rural home, the rural seat of my maternal ancestors, which is called Three Mile Plains. And so this is really what I'm thinking about, even though this book is set in a place, fictional place called Wild Falls. I'm really thinking about Three Mile Plains, Nova Scotia, which is just, if you know that province, it's near Windsor, Nova Scotia. I can still see that soil crimsoned by butchered hog and imbrued with rye, lye, and homely spirituals everybody must know. Still dream of folks who built or cracked like shale. Christian twisted his hands in boxing. Morocco who ran girls like dogs and got stabbed. Lavinia, her teeth decayed to black stuff, her love making still in demand, spitting black phlegm. Her pension after 20 towns. And turf, suckled on anger that no Baptist church could contain, who let wrinkles eagerly seize her moist wound when she was just 13. And the tyrant son that lived from barbed wires being flayed and charred the idiot crops to depression and hurt my granddaddy to bottle after bottle of sweet death, his dreams beaten to one tremendous pulp until his heart seized choked, his love gave out. But beauty survived, secreted and fake trains snorting in their pens, in veins and spaces were cold black mirrors, in strange colors of stroking name, banjo time, blind boots precise, ornate, rich needlepoint, and in my love's dark orange skin that smelt like orange peels and tasted like rum.
good God, I remember my creator in the old ways. I sit in caverns and stare at my fists. I led earth into bricks and water into wine. Still nothing wrongs my wintry exile. Neither prayers nor fine love, neither votes nor hard drink. For nothing heals those things starved in green beds but love or pain. A screw jammed in thick, straining wood. And that's all that is in this book, in the voice of a character by the name of X. And I'm going to continue with that character with this poem, which is titled The River Pilgrim, A Letter. And in this poem, X is writing to his would-be beloved Shelley, who he's not seen for 5 years. And there's also something else about this poem. For me, in particular, this is a very important poem for me as a poet and my development as a poet. I hope I'm still developing, but for this time in my life, I wrote this poem. It was I can remember it because it was New Year's Eve 1988 when I wrote this poem, and I was living in Ottawa at that point. But this is called The River Pilgrim, A Letter, and that's because it's a rewriting of Ezra Pound's translation of a very famous poem by the Chinese poet Li Po of the Tang Dynasty. And Pound gave the poem the title The River Merchant's Wife, A Letter. And that's a poem that I first read when I was 16. And a poem that confirmed in, for me, the desire to be a poet. And so it was really important for me to rewrite it and claim it for myself. So this is what I'm trying to do in this particular poem. And again, for me as a poet, it was extremely important. If you know Pound's version of Li Po's poem, Pound writes it, of course, in free verse. Aesthetically, and in terms of my own poetics, at this point in my life, in my later 20s, it was important for me to prove that I am a contaminator of blank verse, was still an efficacious vehicle for poetry. And so I rewrote this in blank verse, which you may not hear very clearly, but that's what it is. I have added pentameter lines, 10 syllables each, to deliberately oppose Pound's free verse. But also, this poem is also written strongly with the influence of John Coltrane's saxophone playing, which you're also not going to hear. But I can tell you it was on while I was writing the poem. And so it was my way to both, on one hand, restore standard verse, while at the same time deviating from it by going towards jazz. And the last line really makes that clear. But anyway, I'm sorry for the long digression and introduction of the poem. And here it is, The River Pilgrim, A Letter in the Voice of X. At 18, I thought the Sisabu wept. 5 years younger, you were lush, beautiful mystery, your limbs scrolls of deep water. Before your home lost in roses, I swooned, drunken in the village of Lava Falls, and brought you apple blossoms you refused, wanting heat smelled wood smoke blues and dried smelts, wanting some Mildred's dumb, unlettered love. That made fate's charm xylophone tracks that rang to Montreal. I scribbled with postcard O's printed in the fleur saw wrong come the sun. Sad watercolors from Negro exiles in France. And dressed Paris white with lepers. Soft cripples finger ponds under elms. Drink blood into young debauchery. The glasses clear with Cointreau, rain and tears. You hung the moon back with crude, crooked palms that no voice could straighten, not even all of his joke guitars, that he was going to die with a bullet through his stomach. Innocent, you curled among notes that scaled with sand, though, from windows agape, and remained in southwest Nova Scotia, while I drifted sad and tired in the east. I have been gone 4 springs. This April, pale apple blossoms blizzard. The garden flutes, E-flats of lilacs, G-sharps of lilies. Too many years are past. Past the marble and pale flowers of Paris. Past the broken tubist guitars of Arnold. Shelley, I'm coming down through the narrows of the Sisabu River. I will write beforehand. Please come out to meet me. As far as Gilbert's Cove. And I talked about that last line, please, come to meet me as far as Gilbert's Cove. Actually, that's a reference to James Brown, please, of course. And I know it's very subtle, but being a black poet, rewriting English modernism, it was important for me to have that pop cultural moment in there, although most people aren't going to catch it. But then again, if you do happen to hear the music for my opera, that I wrote with the composer James Rolfe, Beatrice Chancy,
which Joe Pavato mentioned. If you listen very closely, you're going to hear some Parliament Funkadelic piano riffs, which came from James and I exchanging tapes of music and so on. And I turned him on to or tipped him to Parliament Funkadelic. So the connoisseur of African-American funk is going to hear some of that in this new music slash classical music opera. But you have to listen close. Yes, indeed. Anyway, a couple more pieces from Lionel Falls. This is in the voice of a character by the name of Shelley. One of the things that happened for me in putting together this book, which again was based on that year working with folks in the rural black community in Nova Scotia, is that not only did I have to come to another understanding of poetry for myself, that one that was rooted in my own culture and heritage, the other vital thing was listening to people talk, and especially women, listening to women talk. And black women talk. That was extremely, extremely crucial and interesting and useful for me as an artist because, frankly, their way of speaking was a little bit more closer to truth than some of the ways in which guys spoke. And that's not to be too gendered here, but that's how it came across me. And I also think a little bit of my own family. My father, it was a really strange turnaround of things. My mother had a teaching certificate that she was the one who was most close to black culture, even though she had a teaching certificate and gone to college and all the rest of it. My father only had grade 10, but he was the one who was very British in his diction, his vocabulary, his orientation, his style, his speech, even in terms of popular culture. And so there was this bifurcation in my family in terms of the orientation of my parents towards different aspects of culture, which I'm really happy about now, so I got the best of both worlds, so to speak. At the same time, in terms of, I'm just listening to black women talk in the countryside, again, with a particular kind of orality and a particular kind of truth that came from that, that I found very, very entrancing, and probably for me, also, it's subconsciously a memory of my mother's voice. From my own boyhood. So here it is. This is in the voice of the character Shelley, who X has just been romanticizing heavily, while here she is answering back to X, and it's titled The Wisdom of Shelley. You come down after five winters, X, wisdom of roses and words, 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 brazen as brass. Like a late blizzard, you bust in our door talking April and snow and rain, lit on the table with poems, as if we could trust them. I can't. I heard Pa tell Ma how much and much he loved, loved, loved her. And I saw his fist fall so gracefully against her cheek. She swooned. Roses got thorns, and words do lie. I've seen love die. So that's it for X. It's all over for him. Now, this is, I'm going to read you one more piece on Lionel Falls. Maybe two more, but this one is a little bit longer. It's also in prose, and it's also going to attempt to capture the voices of some black women, including, for that matter, my mother, my aunt, my great-aunt, as well as some people in the communities, plural, which I was working. And it's called The Symposium, No Apologies to Plato. And this is in the voice of Shelley's mother, Cora, who's talking to another daughter of hers, Missy, about romance and life and love and all the rest of it. So, anyway, here we go. Don't give me nothing to jog out, Missy, and hold up nothing to holler for. Just sit back, relax, and be black. I'm not learning about the men's, so you think the bitter foolishness I've suffered. A little thoughtful can save your trouble. Missy, you got to lie to get a good man. And after you get him, you got to be set to hurt him, to hold him, to help mine Chucky. If you don't, or won't, or can't, you got to be stepped on, pushed round, left it on, beat up on, cheated on, whipped like a black fool, and cast out your own. Now, don't you suck your teeth, cut your eyes at me. I'll be finished in a hot second. Now you'll hear this gospel truth from me, my oldest, eat and sleep in my house. Thus cut your sass. Pack a spare suitcase, one for him. If it proves doublish, it'd be easier tossing out that way. Put one change of clothes into it, he can't beg and buggy for nothing. If it be too quiet,
He'll ruminate and feel that bottle more than will you. Wrong will be his mouth and meat for must. They'll spoil him for anything. Won't be fit to drive his nail no more. So when he sees the truck, snaps the long ass son of God in the head, Tom lays his black ass body up and drives him out. If the said fool don't come back sober, he don't come back. Am I lying? And he'd be sweet looking and heavy nature man on his tall monument. And he takes up with some steady woman. Oh, tells up to the chance he's about to bring you. Just tell him up and help in his monkey in a dress. And raise tickles. At least tickle yourself. Don't give him no shakes. And if that don't work, then it's another black word. Grab yourself a second man. Watch out for two-faced chroniclers. These women will grin in your face if it's a news but you and your man. And just you chuck their trashy talk and make your man groan and gruff and get all upset. These gold-dust whores keep you on your back right in your bed and keep them away. That's how they act. I know. I can trick so bloody much. And they don't care if it's a used law, a second-hand law, a stolen love, because it's love all the same. And if it's good to you, they'll try to trick some too. So don't put no business on the streets to conduct between your sheets. Or if some big mouth, some bugsy type of black bitch not to mess, she's terrible looking anyway. A knife gash across her face would just be an improvement. Missy, give me some of that bottle. Preacher touch the filthy side, but I feel kind of zigzaggy today. If some woman is grinning at your man, tell her straight. If it went shit that you want some of that too. Make us get down with a fresh food for like everything you got and don't give a single black penny back. Missy, life's nothing but guts, muscle, nerve. All you got to do is stay black and die. So, terrible advice, of course. Now, this story, as Joe Cavallo said, is like a novel written as poetry. In fact, it is a poem novel, so it is a narrative. And it involves love and death and so on. And so, in the middle of the book, the broken-hearted ex begins to court Shelley's sister, whose name is Sila. And it's a 1937 blues. And so I'll read this last piece from Wild Falls, which is called King Bee Blues. And this is from ex to Sila. And here it is. I'm an old King Bee honey, buzzing from flower to flower. I'm an old King Bee sweet, humming from flower to flower. Women got good pollen. I get some every hour. There's lily in the valley and sweet honeysuckle rose too. There's lily in the valley and sweet honeysuckle rose too. And there's pretty black-eyed Susan. Perfect as the night is blue. Now, you don't have to trust a single black word I say. Now, you don't have to trust a single black word I say. But don't be surprised if I sting your flower today. Anyway, working in the Annapolis Valley really encouraged me to go in this kind of folk direction in the poetry. And again, Wild Falls is a result of this. And the plot of this story also involves a murder of a black man by a white man, and the white man is exonerated by an all-white jury. And even though this work purports to be fiction, that incident is based on a true story that happened in 1985. And I was involved as a social worker in trying to get an appeal of the acquittal of the white killer of this particular black man. And so that story is at the heart of Wild Falls. So even though, again, I said it in the 1930s, it seems to be nothing but romance and all the rest of it, there was a story that anybody around at that time would know, because it was a major incident in the black community and caused a high degree of organizing around it all across the province in an attempt to get an appeal of the acquittal, which was unsuccessful. But as part of the process, I ended up having a meeting with the Attorney General of Nova Scotia, along with the affected family, in the spring of '86. So while all that was going on, I was also writing these poems and putting together this book for the most part of that impulse. To finish up the personal narrative, '86, after deciding I was really disastrous as a social worker, I decided I'd go back to school and get an MA. So I went to Dalhousie and studied more poetry. And at the same time started a community newspaper called The Rap, R-A-P, The Rap. And even though it was only a monthly, and only 8 pages, and 7,000 search,
Only here once a month. It was a two-person operation. My assistant on the paper was a guy who sometimes sold advertising, Mark Day. But we sold enough advertising that we managed to make about $12,000 a year on that little paper, which was enough in 1986-87 to actually buy winter clothes. So it was good. And the best part, I had two cars, by the way, and had lost both of them. One had completely rusted out. I only paid $200 for it, so completely rusted out. It was 1979 AMC Concord with a rust bucket. In fact, you think I'm kidding. I'm telling you the truth. When I bought that car, that's my uncle's place. He got out some duct tape to hold the thing together. I'm serious. You think I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. And if anybody ever slapped the hood of the car, all you could hear the rust falling down. You could hear it. This thing was a death trap. I'm lucky that I got rid of multiple cars, sold it for $50. So, I didn't do too badly. Bought a 300 and sold it for 50. Not too bad. But anyway, so I went back to school and started this little community newspaper called The Wrap once again. We covered black community stuff, North End, Halifax stuff, working class stuff. We covered the arts. That little newspaper had one page that was always dedicated to poetry. Despite that it was only an 8-page paper, one page is all dedicated to poetry, and published poems from all over the country, white and black, in that little paper. And the result of it was, we broke a couple stories in Halifax that the major media couldn't get hold of, because we had community contact they didn't have. And so once again, I got offered a job on the Daily News. To kind of work for them. And at the same time, virtually on the same day, I got a call from the office of the Howard McCurdy member of Parliament to come and work for him. And so the paper was saying, you gotta get a car. And Howard was saying, I'm gonna start you off at 24G. Well, as I just said, I'm getting 12G a year, and I thought, I'm 26, 27, I probably should start looking at 24G as opposed to 12. So I gave the paper to a buddy of mine who's still in Halifax, and he kept it going for another year or so. And off I went to Ottawa, working for an NDP member of parliament, the only black member of parliament at the time. And I worked for him for 4 years, 87 and 91. And Howard was the NDP critic for Science and Technology, Post-Secondary Education, Human Rights International, I took a bunch of science and tech. And I think I'm forgetting at least one other thing, but he was also someone who had been involved in the civil rights movement in Ontario in the 1950s. He had been the president of the National Black Coalition of Canada. He had contacts all across the country in terms of black movement, black community, and so on, and he was still involved, even though he was a parliamentarian representing the people of Windsor-Walkerville. He was still involved. In fact, set a standard that no MP says is met. I'm going to say it. I don't care what you talk about, Gene Augustine or whoever. None of them has been as front and center when they were there. None of them was as front and center as Howard was as a backbench MP for the 9 years he was there. And when the 9 years he was there from 84 to 93, he was always the only black MP in the House. And he always represented the community every way that he could. And I had a very minor role to play in that. But another thing about Howard is that he was Dr. Howard McCurdy, PhD. He had been a professor of biology at the University of Windsor. He'd been chair of his department of biology at the University of Windsor. He published 45 scientific articles, along with all his community involvement and so on. There was a role model, and I was working for him. He also contested the leadership of the NDP in 1989, came fifth in that seven-person contest. So I was really working with somebody who was a stellar person in terms of being a role model. And so that's why I said to Howard, I'm going to leave the office. This is in 1990. I'm going to quit. I'm going to go to Queens. I've been accepted here in a PhD program. And I was definitely following Howard's footsteps. And he said, don't quit. What you're going to do is you're going to continue working for me. I'm going to give you one day off a week. It'll be Tuesday. That's a slow news day on the Hill. And test it. Tuesday is a slow news day on the Hill. Still is. So Tuesdays, you're going to go to Queens, take all your courses on Tuesday. So that's what I did. I rented a car and drove down every Tuesday to Kingston, and nobody would see me otherwise. I rolled in first thing Tuesday morning, I got up at 5 o'clock, it was a 2.5-hour drive down to Kingston from Ottawa, Highway 15, for those of you who know it, bad highway. Got down there by 8:30 for the first class, and by the time the last class ended, it was 4:30, jumped in the car, drive back up to Ottawa, 7 p.m. And I did that for the whole 8 months of the first year of the PhD program. And I love it. Obviously, I have to honor Howard for that. That was a wonderful gift to me. So again, I didn't want to go into any debt. I didn't want any debt. And I couldn't get any scholarship. The only thing I could get was a general graduate school loan. There's no way that was going to work out. So he actually saved my bacon for that first year. I was very lucky. And then I saved up enough money, and I quit the next year in 91, which I had to do. I just had to get it on my own, so to speak. But on the other hand, I'll never forget, and I'll always be thankful for those 4 years I had working on the Hill with him and being involved in the various community things we were involved in. Wild Falls came out in 1990. I put together an anthology of Black Nova Scotian writings. I thought it was important. Because one thing that happened when I was working on Wild Falls, people say, you're the first Black poet in Nova Scotia. And I think, yeah, you're right. Gee whiz, that's pretty cool. But then I started thinking, I said, well, wasn't there somebody who published something in 74? Sure enough, there was. Wasn't somebody published something in 75? Sure enough, there was. And so I started thinking, what were all those other people who published stuff? And so I decided I would go and find out who they were and put selections of their work in an anthology. And so I did, that was my first anthology, 2-volume, Fire on the Water, and then follows with Black Nova Scotia writing. But all the impulse for it was to be able to answer that question. The next time somebody said, you know, the first Black poet is in Nova Scotia, no, I'm number 4, actually. And there were 3 others ahead of me. And not only that, but a lot of these young people actually published books. I found a slang narrative that was in the public archives of Nova Scotia. Nobody has ever commented on it before. It's called The Book of the Bible Against Slavery by John William Robertson. I found it. And I'm standing there in the archives, I'll never forget that moment, holding that slave narrative in my hands. A slave narrative published in Halifax in 1852. So that really convinced me that we had to do some serious scholarship about the roots of Black writing well, at that point in my life, I was still thinking Nova Scotia and the Maritimes. But then you got that came out, and fast forward, I gave a lot of readings around different places for Wild Falls and ended up attracting notice of professors at Duke University, who were very interested in my work, especially the Black Nova Scotian stuff and the anthology. And so they asked me to come down and apply for a job, which I was only too happy to do. And I finished my doctorate in 1993 in Queen's University. I'd like to say my phone was not ringing. It was not ringing. Nobody was calling. Phone was not ringing. Couldn't get any interviews. Nothing was going on at all. So I was looking at 1985 being repeated all over. I'm going to have to go back and paint more ship decks. Was that going to have to be the case? And I was looking at it, I was thinking, gee, was I somehow out of paint? So I got something to fall back on. But in any event, I have to be honest here and say that a couple of East Coast institutions, as well as College University in Ottawa, were also very interested in me and began to put together some projects to try to get me hired. But while they were working on trying to do those kinds of things, Duke called and said, flying you down. You got an interview. See, great. Fly down with February. Blossoms are out. Everything smells really nice. Flowers everywhere for crying out loud. And I left Ottawa and the snow was up to here. And I was like, I hope these guys hire me. I really hope they hire me. And luckily enough, I got hired, which completely shocked the folks at Queens. They were like, oh my God, how did you do that? So it was magic. Just sheer magic, that's all. But in any event, I ended up luckily being hired here at that point, the number one English department in the entire world. And so I went down there and continued to work on Black Canadian stuff and published a whole bunch of essays and published more books. And eventually, and comes to the end of my narrative, as we've done all the work I was doing on Black Canadian writing, McGill University invited me or appointed me as a visiting sequencer in Canadian Studies at McGill. That was in 98-99. And so I came back to Canada. I was still based at Duke and still based in Durham, North Carolina. But I came back, basically moved to Montreal in order to take up that position. Partially moved to Montreal to take up that position. And while I was there, U of T came calling and said, would you consider taking up a position here? And because my research was always bringing me back to Toronto and Montreal and Halifax especially all the time, I figured it would be a good thing to be back here on this side of the border. And so migrated back to Canada in 1999 to take up that position at the University of Toronto.
And at the same time, I kept working on more things, including the opera. I know I've lost track of this whole narrative, but the opera of Beecher's Chancy, which I deliberately wrote because I wanted to talk about slavery in Canada, slavery in Nova Scotia, which had been totally forgotten and elided and repressed. And working on that project, just before I went down to Duke, I visited with my mother, and she mentioned to me I had two cousins who were hanged in 1949 for murder in Fredericton. And it was the first time in my life, I was 34, and it was the first time in my life to hear about these two guys. And so I started doing research about them, their names were George Rufus Hamilton, and that was the point of this novel, which came out last year, which has been nominated for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best First Novel. I just got to say that. That's the result of my American years, the self-promotion and all that. That's where it comes from. But in any event, I learned to do that. That Duke taught me that. I'm glad that the critics, generally, including here in Edmonton and Calgary, have liked this book a lot. It's meant a lot to me, and it's sold decently, and it's now been published in the United States and in Britain, too. So I'll read you a little tiny piece from this book, which again, I wrote this about my relatives after doing a whole lot of research about them. But the other important point about this story is that when I looked around the documentary, I didn't see anything that talked about the history of the community in fiction, and especially in a way that talked about the harshness of life for folks, especially in the 30s and 40s in the Maritimes, and especially for black men, which is not to say that black women also did not have it very, very hard and very tough. But it was also specifically, as far as I'm concerned, being a black male myself, specifically some issues that I wanted to deal with in pertaining to these two young guys. The real life George and Rufus Hamilton died when they were 22 and 23. And just to tell you about the story, they needed money. They concocted a plot to go out and hit somebody over the head with a hammer. They called up a taxi driver and decided to slug him in the back of the head, which is exactly what happened twice. Their victim died almost instantly. And they got about $200 in 1949 money. They made no attempt to get away, but they did destroy evidence heartily and successfully. And the only reason why, initially, I think the main reason why the case was solved as early as it was because George Hamilton had a guilty conscience. He also had two children. And two very, very young children. One had just been born, which is one of the reasons why he went out to commit this robbery. And so he went to the police and confessed that his brother did it. Yeah, Rufus did it. And so the RCMP, of course, smartly arrested him too, along with Rufus. He testified for the Crown against his own brother. There were two separate trials. Didn't help him. He forgot he was a young black man. And that he also had taken part in a horrible crime. And so they were both convicted and duly hanged back-to-back, July 27, 1949, while a mob of 10,000 people filled the streets of Fredericton. 10,000 people filled the streets of Fredericton to try to see or hear whatever they could see at 2 a.m. in the morning. Right? And I think that's an important detail when I think about Kansas being all peaceful and peace, order, good government, and law-abiding and all the rest of it. Well, no, the folks were just as in a sense, bloodthirsty and curious as the American counterparts were. I give a quotation in this book. Actually, there's a kind of a quotation from a judge who actually said that guys are better off being hanged here because in the South they would simply be lynched. But here they had a trial first, so they should be happy. That was actually said. That's Canadian liberalism. But anyway, I just, we can go over and run trial. Anyway, I got to laugh about it, but it was a horrible thing. But I really want to talk about race relations in that time, because even now, we like to mythologize our race relations in Canada so much better than in the United States, so much more peaceful than in the United States. And I think that's just a big, big lie. That's all it is, just a lie that we tell ourselves, make ourselves feel better. And so I really want to understand the milieu in which my parents grew up. My mom was born in 1939, my father in 1935. And they grew up at a time when it was still very palpable, visible, visceral racism was present. And I want to try to understand this. That's what this book deals with. And so on. I'm not going to read you some of those parts, though. I'm going to read you a nice part. This is about the fictional parents of George Rufus Hamilton. His names are Cynthia and Asa.
And Asa is talking about when he first met Cincy. And at this moment, she's supposed to give birth to Rufus. George is already about a year old. She's supposed to give birth to Rufus here. But anyway, smoking. Asa looked up at the smoke-toed stars. He thought of Cincy Clarkson the way she was when she and he was in love way back then. Her ebon chestnut hair, her onyx and honey eyes, her black locks, tartan skirt, her legs smooth as cool wood, her red brown skin, just her overpowering beauty down by Gibson's Woods, that oasis of nice looking people who are always throwing all night parties. He snatched her up to him right there at a dance, harmonica blazing and fiddle sizzling, and too much rhythmic clapping. He'd not been certified with the beer when his eyes caught snake in that dreamy face. Too alarmingly splendid. Blossoms were just jettisoning off the apple trees and pastures up, down the Annapolis Valley. 50 miles of apple blossoms, sir. Pink, white, ivory, cream, rose blossoms. Delicate to look at, fragile to touch. And the dance was in a barn just off some tan man's pasture. Blossoms was a crizzle on the trees. Cynthia had not said no, he'd up and asked her to dance. So he took her up small as she was, light, well, light. And told her about the impromptu dance floor. Some planks slung down among the stacked hay. Some lamps for light, some beer for flavor, and some apple blossoms for a scent. His hands on her waist. Ah, it was like holding a plate of petals. They danced. They got all hugged up in a corner. Cynthia was sheathed light. Her skin was sheer copper glass gold. Later, four clean oxen shimmering in spick and span moonlight shimmied a cart over a puddle-pop dirt road. Nearby, the squabbles of apple blossoms, squabbles of pear blossoms. Cynthia's dress rustled like a Bible page. She looked a gold-leaf Cleopatra, small with noxema and pines. Asa took up Cynthia's light hand and kissed her fingers where they sat, trundled along in the cart. She looked at him, her eyes blinking as arrogant and soft as wine. Then she smiled, and it was as beautiful as the moon. Her beauty was pure sugar in his mouth. In 1923, Cynthia was 16 and Asa was 21. They went to a teacher and got attached forthwith. Asa saying to his wife, "You looking good in that wedding ring." The ring was only silver still. The view of his kisses upon her made her own kisses wetter and freer. The only thing she wore was sunlight. They sipped down out of the rum then sucked madly on each other. In the morning she put her face on, Asa put the coffee on. They served each other breakfast in bed every day that first summer. The bed springs screeched like church organs. There was hot biscuits, slabs of bacon. They buttered each other up sweetly, gobbled each other down hotly. In each other they had a little heaven, briefly, maybe fried mackerel and buckwheat pancakes and dairy for Sunday breakfast, maybe buttermilk and brown bread and blackstrap molasses bread and lolly for Sunday supper. Now a tall jug of ice water on the table beside the steaming hot plates. Later, a small dish of ice water on the floor beside the sweating hot bed. Asa liked the kind of love where the lovers get all sweaty. I'm not sure how we have for time, but let me just stop here for a second and ask you if you have any questions for everything I've said. I realize the content has been very scattered and very autobiographical. But that's also conducive for conversation, perhaps. So please, feel free.
Which I'm not doing right now.
Mic's on.
Did you give up on rock and roll?
No, I haven't given up on rock and roll. I've become more acclimatized to other kinds of music. Let me just say, I think the music I listen to mostly is jazz. And all this, I gotta say, like all of us, I mean, somebody did a study a while ago saying that you're only nostalgic about the music you've heard up to age 21. And so, of course, the teenage pop songs, some pop songs I heard as a teenager, I gotta get somewhat nostalgic over. So when Time Life does the fabulous 70s in the early hours of the morning, where they're supposed to tie up and die in, or they talk about soul music, the soul classics of the 60s and 70s and so on, or they talk about the 80s, Time Life Records. I always want to get on the phone and call up and say, send me that, send me that, send me three copies of everything that you got, and so on. So I end up talking for that music of that era. The pop music of that era, but in terms of every music I listen to, it's mainly jazz. But, as I mentioned already, I had the experience working on an opera, Beatrice Chancy, with James Rolfe. And the music of that opera basically referenced bossa nova, which we were both listening to, as I mentioned already, funk, classical music, classical opera, bel canto tradition of Italian opera, and so on. All that is in there, and I was really happy to have experience with, or to listen to all those different kinds of music. And they're all there in that opera composed by James Rolfe. But then I got a chance to do a second opera called Cavecite. And I wish I brought along a CD from Cavecite so I could play some music for you. Cavecite is a jazz opera composed by Dee Dee Jackson, born in Ottawa and now living in New York City. And you got to take my word for it, unfortunately. It's so good. It is so good. I'm serious. This is what I'm getting a deep teaching. The deep learning is coming across here. I'm being honest with you. It is an excellent, excellent, excellent piece of music. And it fuses together different musical traditions. The main thing of it is jazz, but there's also a South Asian character whose name is Lakshmi Bharati. It's a character, and that's her name. So we have the only stage productions we've done, there have only been two so far. Her character was played by Karen Ahluwalia, who's a world-renowned interpreter of classical Indian ghazals. So there's South Asian Bollywood-style vocals as well, which I happen to love very, very much as part of the jazz opera. Also, there's a Chinese-Canadian character named Colette Chan, and she's actually played by a Korean-Canadian woman by the name of Yoon Choi. Yoon Choi comes from Whitby, Ontario, and she has her own jazz band in New York City. And so she plays Colette, so we have her particular musical stylings, or song stylings, as well as those of Karen Ahluwalia, and then we have in the two productions we've done so far, we've had the role of Ovid Rambeau, played by Hayden Neal, the lead singer of a group called Jack Soul. And for anybody who's listening has a certain fascination with pop culture, you know who I'm talking about, and you know the group I'm talking about, and you know they had a huge hit last year with that song, I Still Believe in Love. And they're also another singer is a guy by the name of Dean Bowman from Harlem, New York. The only American singer in the whole thing, and he played the role of Malcolm Stage from Halifax, who's a jazz saxophonist. And Dean Bowman is the lead singer of a group called Screaming Headless Pumpkins. So this is a long way of saying that I'm not involved with rock and roll music, but I still am involved with composers. And I'm really happy to have that connection. And finally, it's still answering your question. The third, I got a commission. We won a commission. Dee Dee Jackson and I won a national competition for a commission last year to write another opera. And this is going to be a sort of classical slash jazz. It's not going to be purely jazz. It's not going to be purely classical. It's going to mix the two. At least that's the idea that Dee Dee Jackson has. And the subject matter is Pierre Elliott Trudeau. My third opera, his second, and I always wanted to do a story based on him, but don't worry, it's not going to be like the Trudeau that you see on TV. This is going to be a different kind of Trudeau, it's going to be a funky Trudeau. It's going to be a soulful Trudeau, speaking back English. I'm just kidding about that part. I'm speaking back French, no, I'm just kidding. But it is going to be different in the sense that what we are going to choose, what we choose to highlight in this opera is the multicultural dimension of Trudeau. And we forget that. We always talk about multiculturalism and bilingualism and federalism and constitutionists being the legacies of Pierre Trudeau. But I think all of those programs, all those policies flow from the man himself, who is not only Quebecois and is not only Canadian, but was also, as he described himself, a man of the world, citoyen du monde. And was somebody who was very comfortable. He was more comfortable being in China, being in Cuba, being in Tahiti, than he was being in Ottawa. And that's the person who fascinates me. So in this opera, yes, he will sing a duet with Mao Zedong, as he may very well have done in real life. Yes, because. And there will also be a duet with Fidel Castro. Absolutely. Don't worry, Margaret's going to be there too. I got a couple songs with Margaret in there, and Tanya, we're going to try to cover the story, but we're going to change the focus from Quebec to the world, and from Ottawa to the world, and the multicultural thinking that informed his liberalism. And so hopefully it all worked out, but it was supposed to be staged in Toronto. Harbourfront Center, who sponsored the competition late May next year. That's what we're aiming for. I already wrote the first draft in Monte Carlo. Monica, last December, just for the hell of it. I just thought it was also a place that he would have been comfortable being a millionaire. And now he's mid already. I know I already hear the question. What do you, a black guy from Nova Scotia, working class roots, Anglophone mainly, doing? What's your business talking about this white guy, rich dude, playboy aristocrat, francophone, Quebecois, fellow? And my answer to that is, and it's something I've got to think about a while, like, gee whiz, I'm really not the right person to write this story, am I? On the other hand, as a Canadian, I have a right to talk about this guy as a major Canadian figure, like him or hate him, and also to prefer my own viewpoint, my own perspective. And there's a political side to this, because in discussions of the Constitution, the place of Quebec in Canada, the future of Canada, notice, visible minorities are never part of the conversation. They are never part of the conversation. It's always white Canadians, francophone, anglophone, sometimes allophones, who are asked to give their perspective on Canada, the Constitution. It's like we're not, it doesn't really apply to us in a sense, or we're not considered to be Canadian. I think that's really the bottom line. We're not considered to be Canadian. And so therefore, what could we have to say about Quebec or about bilingualism? And in fact, when Quebec City was mounted, one of the strongest pieces of criticism against it was, I was talking about Quebec and I had no right to. That was one of the strongest pieces of criticism against Quebec City, which is exactly why I said, okay, now I'm going to talk about Trudeau. Just to make the point that you can't stop me from talking about whatever I want to talk about as a Canadian, and as a citizen, as an artist, for crying out loud, quite frankly and bluntly. So it's going to be interesting to see what the reviewers have to say about this treatment of Trudeau. Very interesting. I'm not even sure who the singer is going to be, but it may be a surprise. Yes, Lee.
Yes, George, my name is Corinne, and I'm from Montreal, and this is my brother Danny. George, I was discussing with some of my colleagues to tell them that until I came to Alberta 3 years ago, I'd never heard about you. I grew up in Montreal, I was born there, and I went to the French schools, and then later on to the English schools, and studied literature, but was more geared, it seems, to our European authors and Canadian authors in general. And I specifically was wondering how come there seems to be this missing link, and how do you think it's going to be addressed, if ever?
Estienne Dangereux, and that was a true picture to read as
seen.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking for anyway, to answer your question, it's a great question. And it goes right to the head of all the research I've been doing and a lot of interventions I make politically and culturally as a something of a sort of pseudo-public intellectual in quotation marks. But as I answer your question, I've got to say a couple things. First of all, every single black intellectual in Canada is forced to be a historian of some sort, whether he or she wants to be or not, whether he or she is trained to be or not. If you are a black person and you consider yourself being intellectual, you're involved in the academy, you're a writer, you're an artist, you are somebody who makes a living at least based in part on your engagement in processes of thought and dissemination of thought, you're a historian too. And we are all forced to be in that mode because of the fact that history is constantly being erased, And that's a major point. Because it's not just that it's not talked about and it's forgotten or it's erased once. It's under constant erasure. So you publish, just for the sake of argument, you publish a book on, let us say, just for the sake of argument, black domestic workers, Montreal, in the 1950s, 1960s, as Canada began to liberalize its anti-black, anti-Jewish, anti-Asian immigration rules, right? And what comes out, maybe there's reviews all over the place, CBC, Global Mail, La Presse, Le Devoir, Montreal Gazette, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe there's even some reviews in academic journals, right? But after a certain point,
the project will be forgotten. It could never happen. And then 5, 10, 15 years later, somebody else publishes a book. And once again, it's a big splash of publicity and interest. And you have to come up and say that, I already published on that. And the reason why you might find yourself in a position of having to do that is because the culture does not value Black history, does not value Black scholarship and Black research on our history and so on. It is constantly repressed and erased, as if it had never happened. And so, I'm not surprised that you have these questions. This is not to say anything about myself being great or famous or nothing like that at all. I mean, why should you know anything? Why should you hear anything about me? And that's, I think, a legitimate question. On the other hand, I think it's highly unlikely that you'll hear anything about any Black writer, intellectual, and so on. I hope that is changing. I hope it is. And I hope I don't sound too negative. But I do have the impression, I have the feeling, that I personally am constantly fighting against forces of cultural erasure that are ongoing, because of the general belief that I think that we have in Canada, that to acknowledge the presence of history and achievements of Black people in Canada means we have to acknowledge white racism in Canada too. And because we don't want to acknowledge that, because only America is racist, one way to get around that problem is just to constantly pretend that Black people don't exist. Or if they exist, but they don't have any history, don't have any problems. Everybody is always just arriving. Just as the history is constantly being erased, we are always only just getting here. We only just arrived. We don't have any roots. We don't have any history. Because if we have history, we have to talk about the problems. And the oppressions and everything else. And so the best way to handle that is just pretend that it never happened, that we were never here. So I'll give you a quick example, a kind of funny one. That really happened. As you all know, recently in Toronto, there's been a spate of shootings, many of them perpetrated by young Black men against other young Black men. There's been some discussions about it because, unfortunately, one of the victims of these shootouts was a young white woman in late December last year. And so finally that prompted a whole slew of public debate. And as part of it in Toronto, and as part of that debate, a Philadelphia preacher, I like that, right? Something out of an American presidential campaign. A Philadelphia preacher, once again, but anyway, a Philly preacher comes to Toronto and says, you guys have problems, but don't worry, you've got to work it out because you don't have any history of slavery in Canada. And he has to be forgiven because he's African American, and of course, why does she know anything about Canada? So it's not a problem. Now, of course, people duly did write letters into the Toronto Star to say, but there was slavery in Canada. Right, and that was good that they did that. It was wonderful to see those letters. But then, a day or so later, another person writes a letter in, which gets published, and he says, there was slavery in Canada, but it was good slavery. you just could not have the impression created that slavery in Canada could ever have been as bad as it was in the United States. You know, this gets to the level of propaganda. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I'm trying to say here, that we teach ourselves propaganda. We spew it out constantly, all the time, especially around race relations, because we want to repress any discussion of real divisions in our society around race, or the history of those divisions, constantly erased. And so a lot of that pressure for propaganda purposes to erase that history means that the books, the articles, the songs, everything that have to do with laying down some kind of claim to some kind of historical presence in the country is always under the threat of erasure itself, too. And so one is constantly forced, as I said before, every intellectual, Black intellectual is forced to be an historian, and I think that's going to continue to be the case for generations, plural, to come, until there is a change in our social dynamic in this country, until we're able to be mature enough to face ourselves and understand that, well, the UN may say we're the best country on earth, and while we may be the best country on earth, that doesn't make us perfect. And then we have a whole lot of social issues that we have to contend with. And I do think that if we begin to face ourselves at our demons and our problems, then we can start talking about our real history, and not the fake one that we give ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have a question. I just started with Colin. I happened to work years ago
on a research project. It was about actually a participation of women in politics in the late 1940s, and progressive, what happened to progressive women, and the impact of the Red Scare, and how they disappeared, really, from political scene. But while I was doing this, it was just your comment on murders, that the Canadian propensity for really enjoying a good murder story, of how much time I actually spent reading, probably more about the murders than my actual research project than I was working on at the time. There was actually a lot at the time in the late 1940s. But my question has more to do with when you're writing. And it's obvious that your audiences are multiple. I mean, there's a lot of people you are writing for. And I'm just curious, when you are writing, are you conscious of this? You're writing in terms of Black identity and history and voice, and trying to prevent that from being erased or being noticed, to become part of the Canadian public. But you identify yourself as a Canadian as well, and you're also an academic, and there's standards to meet in the academy. So when you are writing, to what extent are you conscious of your audience there? Are you actually speaking to someone? Are you speaking to multiple audiences at the same time? I'm looking at, I don't know if the question or not, but it seems like you're writing for so many people at the same time, and I just thought, how do you keep all that in mind when you are writing?
This goes back, in a sense, to the question that Colleen was asking a moment ago, and I think that part of my own personal campaign against erasure is to try to be a little bit of a bullhorn and to get information out to as many people as I can at one time. Or in different genres, different forms. I mean, as a writer, I'm somebody who's worked with libretti, opera libretti, with stage plays, did a screenplay for a movie that was produced. I've done, of course, all kinds of poetry and the novel. Every single one of those works, not so much the academic essays, but every single one of them is an attempt to have an intervention, to make an intervention somewhere, to say, have you considered this side of our history? Have you considered this experience? Have you considered this particular art form? And I feel that I've got to do that, because otherwise stuff will go unaddressed, because it always gets unaddressed. Even some of the fabulous murders get unaddressed. You want people to think about those murders as well as everything else. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment, but I'm coming back to that example of erasure. A little while ago, just a few years ago, Montreal celebrated the 350th anniversary of its founding, Montreal. And there was no recognition of Marie-Josèphe Angélique. Now, there was one reason, one good reason, is that she burnt down the city. So,
that's a good story.
Yeah, that's a good story. But, you say this is amazing, but if she'd been an American, this would happen in the United States. Even if she burnt down, let's say Detroit, or even New York, people would remember it. Because it would be like, she was a revolutionary, she was a rebel. She cared so passionately for fame, she burnt down the city. That's how they would characterize it. For us, it's like, we're embarrassed that we had slavery. We're embarrassed that a slave woman might have set fire to the city because she was a slave. And so therefore, we're just going to repress all that, hide everything, pretend it never happened. Right? And so now there's a big book just published this year by Philip Cooper, historian, graduate of U of T, not that matters, but I'm going to say it for the record. And she just published this big book on the history of Marie-Josèphe Angélique, which has gotten great reviews all across the country, which deserves. But again, I keep feeling in the back of my mind, well, that's great, but where are the parliamentary speeches? Where are the commemorative coins? Even Riel has been recognized as the father of Manitoba, for crying out loud, despite leading two rebellions against the central government. But where's her memorial? Where's her statue? International Women's Day, there's the speech in House of Commons to say, Marie-Josèphe Angélique set an example for us, all women in Canada. There's somebody who fought back and she had nothing to fight with, except her own wit and her own person, her own body, for crying out loud. But again, this is an example of the erasure. She doesn't come up as an example. She doesn't come up as a symbol, because she's not important. Simple. She's just not important. Now, again, Americans would say, hell, what an example for everybody else. You know, society isn't going to turn around, burn the run down, as used to say in the 60s. And And they would gravitate to her. She would be celebrated. But here, no, she has to be repressed. So, along with your question, I feel that for my own art and intellectual work, everything I do has to be an intervention to try to speak back to some kind of vacancy in historical knowledge, especially historical knowledge, about the presence of various minorities in Canada, Aboriginal people, Black people, because otherwise we continue to accept all these lies that are just propaganda. That's the spirit of society. And so I do try to reach as many people as I can in everything I do. But it's also a strain because generally speaking, my Black readers then have slightly different interests and tastes and expectations than my white readers, generally speaking, are going to have. So I've got to try to reach these two, I'm thinking very general terms, these two general audiences at the same time. And it's something I've always been very conscious of, and I can't say that I'm always very successful, but I do try to keep the interests and needs and inclinations of these two general audiences in mind at the same time in my writing. But I also say the older I get, the less concerned I am about trying to meet everybody's needs. If I want to write what I want to write, and hopefully you're gonna take to it and enjoy it. And if not, well, fine. Life is short. There's always somebody else to read. So, but anyway, yeah, that's just in the only part of my career I did try to meet those two audiences. Any other? Yeah, thank you.
Now, interestingly enough, the local reviewer for the Edmonton Journal, who very much liked the history of Angelique, with Paul's discovery there was slavery in Canada, you know, what was erased in that review was the fact that a play has been written called Angelique by Louis Miguel, and I think that predated that came before the history, right? And so, you know, I think that's kind of a sad erasure because it's a wonderful play.
I don't know where to begin. You're absolutely right. First of all, yes, honestly, definitely, the play precedes Phil Cooper's history, absolutely, by 5 years. It was published in 2000, first stage in 1999.
It was in Calgary, interestingly enough.
Yeah, Calgary, and Chicago, and New York.
Yeah.
So, and also, it was staged as a student production in Toronto in the fall of 2004, 2003 or 2004, I think it was 2004, actually, that staged in Toronto. But, and I know Lorena Gale personally, she's a wonderful, wonderful person. By the way, her second published play is called Je ne suis rien. Which is nominated for Governor Gale's Award in 2002. But before Lorena Gale's play, there are four other interventions on the Angelique story, all by Black artists. Mm-hmm. There's a play by Lois Ellie that was published in 1985. Uh-huh. There's a novel in French, juvenile novel by Paul F. Brown, published in Montreal in 1998. There's a song by the soul singer, a political a cappella singer, Faith Nolan, originally from Nova Scotia, called Marie-Joseph Angelique, and that was recorded on her second album, Afterglow, from 1986. There's also, a movie by Michael Jarvis, 24-minute long film by Michael Jarvis in Montreal, written by Michael Falconbridge, which was made in 1999 and played on the CBC, but once every Black History Month. You're going to see it on CBC late at night. So there have been those. And there's also two novels by white Québécois. One Québécoise and one Québécois about Marie-Joseph Angelique as well. And there's a new novel that's going to come out later this year, also by a white writer, white Québécois writer, about Marie-Joseph Angelique. So, given all that attention, actually not all that much attention, but, you know, these are five works by Black folks about her, including a movie, for crying out loud, you would think that the reviewer for the Edmonton Journal might have heard of her story before, or might have heard of slavery before, but again, this is an example. Your anecdote is a perfect example of what I've been talking about, complaining about, really, which is this constant erasure. I saw the review in the Globe and Mail, which I thought, frankly, was a stupid review.
I like saying that as an academic, because you're always supposed to be so balanced in your critiques. I just thought it was a stupid review. Because one of the things the reviewer said for Robert Neal was, everybody knows his story.
Uh-huh.
That was just dumb. That is not to say to the reviewer, look it. Why don't you just go lay on the, because there's some summit teachers at York University in Toronto. So I said, look it. I want to say to that person, look it. Why don't you just go to the student center at York University, the shopping mall at York University, and ask randomly 10 folks you bump into in the student shopping mall, how many of them have heard of Real Stuff Constantly? You can even tell them, woman, break down much, y'all. How many of them are actually going to know what you're talking about? I'm going to promise you zero. Zero would be able to answer that. Like, did it work? Will this person teach us? So for her to go in the book with me and say, oh, yeah, I don't want this book to be necessary because everybody knows the story. It's stupid. And, you know, like I say, to that African American, that was stupid. I've never refrained from bothering to write a letter to the girl to even complain. Because it's an example, perfect example of people not being cognizant of their history and they're not wanting others to be really cognizant of their history. And in fact, what she should have done, that reviewer, maybe the Evanston Journal reviewer, said, what about so-and-so, other people who were impacted by slavery that we know about? Why don't we hear about them? What are their stories? Who's written stuff about them? And again, one reason why I decided to write Beecher's Chancy is because I wanted to talk about slavery and its impact on black family, community, women, etc. So that was my way. In fact, if you look at Beecher's Chancy, the book, it's dedicated to Maria Joseph Angelique. Although I know most people never going to know why I said Maria Joseph Angelique at the opening of that book. Right? It's also dedicated to, just to be mischievous, also dedicated to Evangeline Bellefontaine. Now, how many of you know about Evangeline Bellefontaine? I'm sorry, this is it. Yes, all right. Oh, Okay. Yes, the heroine of Longfellow's poem, which actually, what's his name, Patti LeMay, translated into French, and became a founding document of Acadian nationalism. And so I also wanted to figure her in my introduction to the play about Beecher's Chancy. So anyway, so all this stuff, and I know Dr. Kelly is telling me we're going to wrap up soon. So let me finish up. Thank you for all your questions, and I'm sorry for not going on further to answer, but I've got to read a couple posts from the new book, the Contentious book. Dr. Kelly is the town owner of one copy of Contentious. That was very good, really slick. Now, yes, I do. I have this book only for sale. Now, I know you want to buy a copy. You know what I'm saying? Why you want to buy a copy? This is called Illuminated Verses, as you can see very clearly. Now, I got to explain this book to you. And it's actually a great explanation. It took 400 years of English-Canadian culture to make this book possible. Because there's been nothing like it ever since. I mean, nothing like it before. And there will likely not be another book like this for a very, very long time. And so this is yet another intervention. It's a problematic intervention. I will concede that immediately. It is. Because what I'm doing here is I'm putting before the public, all of you and everybody else, and particularly right now in Canada, a collection of photographs. This book is half photographs and half poetry. The photographs are of black women who are not wearing clothes. They are nude. And they are posed against, this is the good part, for Canadians, all that creative, the good part is that they're posed against landscapes and seascapes. That Canadians like that. It's healthy. It's like, you know, the whole point, I'm joking a little bit, but I'm also being serious, because you've all been to the West Edmonton Mall, and some of us have been to the Rideau Centre in Ottawa, some of us have been to Le Gallery and Les Halles on Montreal, and some of us have been to Scotia Square in Halifax, and some of us, this is really a consideration of shopping malls, what I'm trying to say, is Joe Clark, as well as Trudeau once complained Joe Clark wanted to make Canada become. That in any event, we've all been to shopping malls at least twice a year. You've got all those folks up there selling landscapes. You've seen them. All these terrible, earth-ass landscapes. There's the Rockies. There's a stream. There's a river. There's the sunset over a bunch of jack pine or whatever. And we buy them. We stop, no matter how many hundreds of dollars they cost. We love that stuff. And what we don't like is the nude.
in English Canada. I got to be precise. In English Canada, we do not like the nude. I know I'm overstating this because I saw some of us maybe at this very table who like nudes. But now that's the one side. Not to throw them in those big lectures. I'm kidding a lot here. I've got to read a couple of times before I run out of time. But I do want to say that this book was 11 years in the making because the photographer, Ricardo Suco, taking these pictures mainly when he was working as a photographer in Miami. Back in the early 90s, and that's when I first saw some of these photographs. It was 1993, and as soon as I saw them, I think these are beautiful photographs. I think they are works of art. And from my mind, from my psychology, from my intent, there's nothing erotic, salacious, bad, immoral in any way. From my intent, I also believe from Ricardo's intent, there is nothing of that sort. And again, from my intent, I see these as incredible works of art. Now, I got to tell you the story quickly. For 11 years, I could not find anyone to publish this book. I could not. The publisher's photograph, I hadn't written the prompt yet, but the publisher's photograph, there was nobody who wants to publish these photographs. And I got three major reasons why. One was, this is sexist. This is exploitation of women. This is, of course, bad, wrong. You cannot do that. I understand. The second reason was, this is politically incorrect. It's politically incorrect to show black female nudes. And I also understood that while also rejecting that argument. And the third reason, which I like to joke was the most Canadian reason, is it costs too much money to do full-color photography. So I got all three reasons from different presses at different times, right? But ultimately, Canadian Scholarship Press, which has published this book, was at one point the managing editor of Canadian Scholarship Press was a black woman. Her name is Ophelia Prince, and she's a great writer. She's a fine writer. Ladies of the Night is one of her best books. I highly recommend it. But she was managing editor. She came to me and said, I want to publish a collection of your love poems. After you said, I personally love your love poems, which, of course, warmed my heart very much so. And I said, Althea, I got a deal for you. You want to publish my poetry? Publish these photographs. And she went to my office, looked at the photographs, and said, okay, I'm going to publish them. And I said, what? Are you really sure? And she said, from day one, this is fall 2003, she said, yes, I'm going to publish these photographs. I said, in full color? So I don't have a full cut, but we're going to publish them. So then I went down to Barbados. I spent 5 days in Barbados with Mr. Rum and the Son of Solomon on the beach and wrote most of these poems. There are 37 poems and 30 of them at least got written in 5 days. Looking at the pictures, reading the Song of Solomon, and drinking lots of rum. So anyway, that's the genesis. So you know there are new photographs in this book. You know that. And as I read, I'm going to read a few poems. As I read, I'm going to show you photographs that accompany each poem. So if you're going to feel offended, close your eyes or turn your head. This is it. I'm going to begin with something that's not too hard to take. Here's the photograph. I'll show you the photograph first for this one. I'll show you the photograph first for all of them. As you can see, nothing too bad with that. This poem is titled Frontispiece, and it's my introduction to the whole book. One more thing to say quickly about the whole book is that the poems are an attempt to redo the story of the Greek story of the Muses. There are 9 Muses in terms of Greek mythology. I have 9 Muses as well. But 5 of my Muses are types of black music, soul, blues and jazz, calypso, and reggae. A 6th Muse is poetry herself. And then 2 Muses are African heroines, real-life people who led rebellions. And then the 3rd is an African goddess by the name of Oxum. So that's 9 in total. So I begin with Frontispiece, and the image you see is the 2 women I described as blues and jazz. So here's the poem. Ain't they instantly magnificent, thin sister? Don't their leopard eyes flash, lightning brash? Pirates must stretch across vast spans of stars to snatch the matchless ones to match these eyes. Impossible bells, imposing impish, their beauty can shatter governments. Like Zenobia, who drove Rome bleeding out of Egypt. Like Phyllis Wheatley, whose quill quickened equality. They serve verse, they are subversive, like music, what illuminates this. Call them blues and jazz, shout their praises, bow down to them as if reciting prayer. Blues preach, scatter hums and moans I hear as respect. Jazz declare, grip a melody and tear up the notes. Rear, think they won't mind, embrace this somewhat, let kisses blaze upon their raven silk. Careful, they descend from Queen Magdalena the First. Who? Look her up in the Madagascar histories. She enjoyed beheading the thoughtless. And that's true, there was a queen, Magdalena the First, who beheaded all her opponents. So someone to emulate, most definitely, at different times. Alright, here's a shocking photograph. It's a new photograph once again. This poem is titled Number One Calypso. And it's still fun to nudity, so be careful. Okay, here's the poem. The surf fusses like furs, nothing furs that sigh, hiss of where glides Calypso nymph Negrita. Her platinum eyes plunder phosphorescence when she thrusts from the surf, water leafing, branching from her body, placing her a halo crown of rain. She jumps up, dizzies that green ingrained water, liquid monk velvet lapping sulking Minga silk. Liquid monk velvet lapping sulking Minga silk. She rouses drowsy azure and drizzles sizzling copper. She's a rebel, making urgent, insurgent government. Look at her, Yamaya, ocean goddess, throned upon peacock waves, sheer blue-green iridescence. She embodies philosophy, searing. Her voice surges apocalyptic, the fire next time. So allusions to James Baldwin and so on. I'm trying not to focus so much on the photographs. Give people stuff to think about, too. Anyway, this is number two, blues and jazz. Number two, blues and jazz. Here's the photograph. These photographs, by the way, are taken in Haiti, this particular series of photographs. And for the record, a couple of pictures were taken in Toronto, in Hyde Park. I thought I could joke very quickly. Fine. Oh, yeah. Here's the reason why I thought. Here's about Soul Jack Lane, the publisher. Because he kept saying, Joe, you got to do this black and white. We got to do this black and white. And I finally took him over for some martinis last summer and said, Jack, you can't do it in black and white, and here's why. Because you will lose the skin tones, the various complexions and shades of blackness and brownness that we are. You're going to lose that if you do it black and white. And I'm sorry it took me so long to think of that argument. Because as soon as I said that, he said, you're right. We'll do it in color. Right, Jack. Thank you. Okay. So this is number two, Blues and Jazz. And this is based on the Song of Solomon. And the idea here is that these two different speakers, jazz and blues, are speaking about their relationships to men. But so this is the Song of Solomon, completely reconfigured in every way, shape, and form. Revision. Anyway, jazz croon. I mix up myrrh with my spice, eat honeycomb with my daisy, gorgeous him on Shiraz. I rise up like a rose opens to rain, to open to my beloved spring molasses in my thighs, oozing rose water, yeah, rose mature. I ain't defiled to get filled with grit, and to undress my love of belly banquet of apples, calvados, and wine, to anoint him with brandy and cinnamon, apparel him in sandalwood and silk. My garden fountains unto love, so lover murmurs, yes, ah, no, please, yeah, like that, lovely, okay, Language erecting monosyllabic monuments. Blues note, my fancy say that this you tea black can be a right handsome crow black, eh? His lips be blueberries and his cheeks be black and juicy like plush plums. His all-weather smile promises felt grim and vigor, the hard belt of his male mouth. His eyes be liver eyes, peachy eyes. His man would be blood sausage and tint and feel and fit. His breast be of two sweet black curves, his kingly legs be tires of iron jetting down from mahogany waste. His kisses be tasty suckling tires, mouth roused with licorice and chocolate. To love him is to weep. So there is the spirit of blues and jazz. I claim, I think. Just two more, and then I'll finish. Just two more to end with. This is our number two reggae. Once again, you've been forewarned. And I like reading this because it rhymes. So here it is, number two reggae. Time clicks, rain slicks, limbs mingle, then remix. Pulse quick ticks, eyes transfix. I love a black Madonna. Face acts, signs facts, you relax. Get my cracks, mask no sacks, priest say facts. Loving a black Madonna. No chance, romance, choked by distant circumstance. Nuns in hand, let's slow dance. I love a black Madonna. Dove. Her songs mimic henna, a dusky gold, hinting of honey, abacus, capsules of molasses and cream, where words unfold, chocolate, serenaded, jazz, forged, orgasms. You, 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 I, please, 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 please. And, of course, the last part of that poem is in homage to, again, James Brown. There's a little moment here in honor of the Supremes, but I won't leave that in the interest of time. But it's true, if you know the Supremes song from the mid-60s, I'm standing at the crossroads of love. That's the basis of one of the poems here. Anyway, number two, Oxum. Here's the image. I almost forgot. Number two, Oxum. And remember, Oxum is an African goddess. This is in the voice of Oxum. And she says, my karma wears Mahalia Jackson and Millie Jackson. My scripture guarantees rapture. No colored ladies must ever be as neat as wallpaper. Down yourself in yelling gala yellow. Nails bumble like ancient apiaries. Who can explain M-E-N? Their sex means more explanation needed. All their crack crannies be crazy as if a bovine transiformous epilepsy and the jacked up occidental filtrate. I repel these rappers, cops of cut-cutting ugliness and by-the-book filth, slumming bankers with sanctimonious briefcases, cockamamie nanny boys with no fixed address, cherry beseechers with unparliamentary speeches, nappers, morticians, economists, and ambiguously sordid politicians, men too manly to act humanly, and any cabal of the now Calibans. To hell with their heaven. I like yellow. I love gold. I shop regalia. I adore mirrors and their delicious imagery. I push against rock like water pulsing history. What will dissolve even stone? Generally, why don't I hear a few pieces? I know we gotta stop, don't we? Yeah. Thank you. Any last minute questions? No? Okay, well, this is my commercial announcement. I have only a few copies of this collector's item. which I have no doubt that's what it's going to be. And it's only $20 purchased directly from yours truly. I'll be happy to sign. And remember, for that $20, you are getting 38 full-color photographs and 37 dynamite poems. Thank you.
Thanks for a wonderful couple of hours. It's just been great.
Right.